Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, my fine friends. Welcome to the third episode of this in-between season, which I'm calling season 9.5, of the Tom Petty Project podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Brown. This is the weekly podcast that digs into the entire Tom Petty catalogue, song by song, album by album, and includes conversations with musicians, fans, and people connected with Tom along the way. Last week, we covered a huge song in the Tom Petty canon. Mary Jane's Last Dance was the seventh most played live song in the Heartbreakers repertoire. It was the last original song that Stan Lynch played on with the band, and it was the only new original song on the Greatest Hits package. So it's one of those tracks that, you know, holds a really unique position in the catalogue. Over on Facebook, there was plenty of love for this one, as you'd expect, and Nora Haywood Olson relayed this marvellous little nugget of information. My youngest child is the other music person in the family, and occasionally I will send the links to the podcasts or songs to get their opinion. The opinion on this song: Mom, I think Tom Petty is the only guy to mention the word underwear in three songs. And he's not wrong. Old King's Road, Wilbury Twist, and Mary Jane's Last Dance. And you know what? Nora's youngest? That would be a fantastic quiz question. So I'm going to put that one in my back pocket and save it for later. Also, thanks for sharing the pod, Nora. That's hugely appreciated. Ian Borkowski said, looking forward to listening. Hopefully there's a mention of the alternative chorus that's found on YouTube. Now, I'd responded that it may have been mentioned in the episode, but I was referring to the original Hey Indiana Girl lyrics and had completely and utterly forgotten that there was a mispressing released that had the lyrics Last Dance with Mary Jane, Round the Room and On My Way in the first chorus. So thanks to Jack McNay for posting the YouTube link to that one. I did sniff around to see how many of those mispressed Greatest Hits record are floating around out there, but I couldn't find any concrete information. I wanted to say a huge thanks to Jack too. He found the podcast fairly recently and has crushed pretty much the entire show in a relatively short space of time. And he's left a load of comments on the YouTube channel for me. And I really, really appreciate you connecting. And as I said somewhere, I'll definitely go back at some point and start responding to those comments when I have some time. Because, you know what, you took the time to reach out. So I feel like I really owe you that that time to reach out back. Mary Beth Donnelly was evangelizing a little to me about Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and commented, love the podcast. Thanks, Mary. That song is definitely a 10 out of 10, no question in my mind. So catchy, love the harmonica. And then in brackets, she says, can't believe you don't like CSNY. I'll have to send a playlist to try to persuade you otherwise. And look, I always welcome people trying to turn me on to great music. And it's not that I dislike CSNY, I just don't really know any of their music. What I do know is that Neil Young's voice is a tough one for me to get past, even though the guy is obviously a genius songwriter and a great vocalist. But the ear doesn't want what the ear doesn't want. The Mercurial Pete Nesta from the Honest and Unmerciful Record Review podcast wrote, don't have anything to add that you haven't already said. As you've indicated, the nuances in this song, Mike's little licks in the chorus, the richness of sound introduced by the harmonica, the scene he's able to paint with these seemingly straightforward yet still cryptic lyrics. 10 out of 10, without a doubt. As an aside, I always thought Hit the Last Number was a jukebox reference. But of course, the narrator here is waking up alone before he hits that number. So unless he has a jukebox in his hotel room or he slept in the bar, maybe not. Now, there's another angle to explore. And though I think Pete's right that it makes less sense if you take the approach that the narrator is in his hotel room when he wakes up. You know, obviously that doesn't scan really. But I can tell you that I've dozed off in a bar or two in my young years. So it's not inconceivable that this is a solid interpretation. So he could be onto something, Pete. I don't know. Over on Twitter, the wonderful Richard Hearn commented, a great listen. Thanks, Richard. Weirdly, I always had a massive prejudice against songs that appeared on Greatest Hits LPs without previously being released. But what a great song this is. And the pod is insightful on how the chorus improves. Tom, as always, fantastic on lyrics. And I should say, I met Richard online through one of the other podcasts I do, the Seaside Pod Review, the Queen podcast. And you should really go check out his website, Paragraph Planet. It's a creative writing website which has been publishing one 75-word paragraph every day since November 2008. If you're a writer, go submit a piece for publication. It's part of my weekly routine now. I check that every day, and when I wake up, that's one of my first things I do. And let me tell you, writing something in 75 words, including the title, is harder than it sounds. I was also doing some quick math today, Richard. It means that since 2008, you've published somewhere over 5,000 pieces written by yourself and others, so that's quite an achievement by any standard. Okay, well, that's the social media taken care of this week. Today's episode covers the second new recording included on 1993's Greatest Hits album, Something in the Air. Something in the Air was written and recorded by Speedy Keen for Thunderclap Newman's debut and only album, Hollywood Dream. Thunderclap Newman was a project put together by Pete Townshend of The Who, along with their manager, Kit Lambert, to showcase the talents of Speedy Keen, Jimmy McCulloch, and Andy Thunderclap Newman. Speedy Keen had been a driver for and shared a flat with Pete Townshend, and he also coincidentally wrote the lead track from The Who Sell Out, titled Armenia City in the Sky, making him the only writer outside the band to contribute an original song to a Who album. He then went on to write the track The Heartbreakers covered, Something in the Air. And despite the success of that record, the 1970 album, Keane spent most of the rest of his career as a session musician and a producer. My first memory of this song, though, is definitely not this original version. In the early 1990s, my mum started dating a guy named Paul, who would become her second husband and a huge influence on my musical tastes. He introduced me to lots of bands, including a lot of prog rock, you know, bands like Genesis, and importantly for this story, Marillion, the latter fronted by a huge, intimidating Scotsman known by the stage name Fish. After four albums with Marillion, Fish departed the band and embarked on a solo career, the first two albums of which were the outstanding Vigil in a Wilderness of Mirrors and Internal Exile. The latter of these two had an additional track on the CD version of the album, his cover of Thunderclap Newman's Something in the Air, which was also released as a single in the UK. Now, I loved it pretty much immediately, even though it was much, much different to anything else on that that second record. Here's a little snippet of Fish's version of the song. So you can really tell the production is from the early 90s with that, you know, heavily indie pop influenced drum beat and the big atmospheric arrangement. It also changes up the way those chords descend, and overall, I thought it was a pretty great cover. It also led me to seek out the original single on vinyl, which I think I ended up getting for Christmas one year from my mum. I listened to both versions quite a bit, and before we start talking about the Heartbreakers version, it's worth noting that the original Thunderclap Newman version of this went to number one in the UK and hit number 37 on the Billboard chart. Now listen to this. Tom's version went to number 53 in the UK and number 53 in the US, which is, it's an odd coincidence. The original version is wildly different to the Heartbreakers cover and features a very Beatles-esque ragtime piano bridge played by Andy Thunderclap Newman. It also features one of the most awkward transitions in a number one chart single history. Listen to this. It also features Pete Townshend on bass guitar, and also he did the orchestral arrangement, and it's a lush but very period-sounding mix with barely any power in the drums and an emphasis on Speedy Keen's beautifully double-tracked lead vocal. By contrast, the Heartbreakers cover comes storming out the gate with Stan Lynch's snare roll and floor tom thundering us into the opening lick. The original's also in E with an open E tuning, whereas the Heartbreakers drop it down a full tone and play it in D in a standard tuning. So that makes the chords sound completely different and makes this arrangement, it makes it stand out for me. Tom's arrangement also differs substantially in that middle section, but certainly on the record, where instead of the essentially solo piano jag, we get a much fuller instrumental piece, which again is really, really leaning into the Heartbreakers Beatles influences in that it almost sounds a little bit like I'm the Walrus to me, just for a few beats maybe toward the end. You know, and to pay strict homage to the original, Tom double tracks his lead vocal with Howie Epstein, and we're hearing a fairly unique delivery style from Tom. To this point, I don't recall him singing almost exclusively in his falsetto range, but he shows that he has that string to his bow in addition to those pinched howls and that lazy southern drawl and all the other different colours that he has to his vocal range. And if you check out the version on the live anthology, the doubling with Howie, the twin lead vocal, is one of the best examples, I think, of how those two voices blended together so effortlessly. The other thing that really shines in this version of the song, and mainly because the mix is so good, is Howie Epstein's sensational bass part. It weaves and slithers around like a serpent underneath the flower power feeling chord progression. And for the most part, Howie's always been sort of a deep-in-the-pocket bass player for the Heartbreakers, by which I mean he's rarely doing anything flashy or over the top, but Given a meaty baseline to work with, originally played, of course, by Pete Townsend, he shows that he can roll with the best of them any day of the week. The other major change in this track is the format of the lyrics. Something in the Air is a fairly ominous call to arms. The original was released in May of 1969 when the Vietnam War was still raging at its most furious. Speedy Keen told Zigzag magazine in 1975 that the song, he said, it was a reflection of what I was seeing at that time. The song and the band wasn't a staple of the American anti-war movement in the same way that artists like The Grateful Dead, CCR, Joan Baez, is that the way you pronounce that name? Crosby, Stills and Nash even were perceived to be, but by 1993, the Vietnam War had been over for 20 years and had faded in the public consciousness to not much more than a sort of almost like an aberration on American history. So rather than using the overtly observational third verse, and especially the line, hand out the arms and ammo, we're going to blast our way through here, Tom repeats the first verse. He also switches up the first line of the second verse from the sinister, lock up the streets and houses because there's something in the air, to the much more optimistic and carefree, run through the fields and houses because there's something in the air. To me, these very deliberate changes switch the meaning of the song completely. What starts out as a fairly bleak reaction to a perceived threat becomes an anthem for, well, to quote Ringo, peace and love, I think. The emphasis switches more toward the we have to get it together sentiment rather than the embattled threat of impending doom. The song was originally to be titled Revolution, but as the Beatles had already used that title just a year earlier, the much more ephemeral Something in the Air was chosen, and I do love the title. If you ever try to define the word zeitgeist, you know, to someone who doesn't know what that word means, using the phrase something in the air, there's something in the air, as a synonym is pretty much the best you can do, in my opinion. And this is why Tom is able to co-opt an observation on the Vietnam War into a song that carries a much more hopeful tenor. Okay, folks, it's time once again for a little petty trivia. Your question from last week was this. Mary Jane's Last Dance peaked at number 14 on the Billboard chart, but which was the last Heartbreaker song to chart higher? Was it A, Don't Come Around Here No More, B, Learning to Fly, C, The Waiting, or D, Jamming Me? Well, 1991's Learning to Fly was the lowest charting of the songs I gave you, surprisingly maybe, peaking at number 28. Released on April 20th, 1980, The Waiting topped out at a paltry 19 and was beaten by one position by Jammin' Me, which reached number 18 in 1987. So your answer is A, Don't Come Around Here No More, which peaked one place higher than Mary Jane in 1985, rising to number 13 on the Billboard Hot 100, making it the third highest charting single for Tom and the band. It also means that Mary Jane's Last Dance is the highest charting single Tom ever had as the sole songwriter. Astonishingly, and in a damning indictment of the music listening public, Tom never broke into the top 40 again in the singles chart. Your question for this week is this. Mary Jane's Last Dance was played live for the first time at which legendary LA venue? Was it A, the Whiskey A Go-Go, B, the Forum, C, the Viper Room, or D, the Greek Theatre? Okay, back to the song. I haven't really talked about the individual parts of this track, but I think the things that I've covered off and the stuff I wanted to talk about, they're just a bit more interesting to me. You know, Tom shortens this song up, makes the bridge more a bit more accessible without, you know, losing its sense of the psychedelic and strange. Stan Lynch and Howie Epstein are in rollicking good form, driving this song forward, and whereas last week we learned that Rick Rubin told Stan that he only wanted to hear one drum fill on Mary Jane's Last Dance, there's a very healthy dose of Lynch magic all over this track. Mike and Benmont fill out the sound gloriously with Tom sticking the landing on the rhythm guitar, but overall, it's musically a relatively straightforward arrangement apart from that bridge, which features those squelchy organ and guitar tones, but again, it's abbreviated. There's a fairly persistent tambourine shaking through most of this track, and all in all, it's 3 1/3 minutes of simple, steady rock and roll from Tom and the boys. And where this song comes alive in their hands, though, is that live version from the anthology box set. You hear much more Ben Montench on piano, especially in that bridge, which is far, far closer to the original than the recorded version. Stan and Howie are absolutely locked into the zone in that rhythm section. And considering this is only the third time they played this live that the recording captures, you know, the third of 21 times they would play this track, it's a tour de force live cover. And as well as slaying that bottom end, Howie is crushing a co-lead vocal with Tom that, again, gives that live performance a completely unique feel to anything else in the Heartbreakers catalogue. There's a link in the episode notes to that version as well. Go check it out. So then I think the only thing left to talk about really is what my feelings are about cover versions on albums. This is a greatest hits album, so it's not a really technically a studio album, but I rated the band's cover Feel a Whole Lot Better from Full Moon Fever a 7 out of 10. And that one is a virtually note-for-note cover of the Byrds' original. Here, the Heartbreakers take a few more liberties with the arrangement, at least on this recorded version, but it's still a fairly faithful cover, even utilising that co-lead vocal between Tom and Howie. Tom would then include two more covers on the She's the One soundtrack album, but it shows that maybe he wasn't a huge fan of putting covers on albums. I'd posited that Feel a Whole Lot Better was a fairly quickly done cover to give the record company one more track when they felt that the album was too short and told Tom so. This one is also one of those contractual obligation songs, even though it's a strong cover, and then the Asshole and Change the Locks covers, and we'll talk more about those when we get to the album, are also added into a very different recording that was barely even viewed as a Heartbreakers record by Tom. Now, I don't have any huge soapbox to stand on when it comes to covers. Heck, I'm probably one of the few people who loves Beatles for Sale unconditionally, and six of those 14 songs on that record are cover versions. I love Steve Earle's album of Townes Van Zandt covers, and I think that Lennon's Rock and Roll album is a masterpiece, especially his version of Stand By Me. But for some reason, I think that Tom's songs are always, always better than the covers on the albums. And we got so many covers on the live releases, and they're always better than any of the studio recordings, that I just think it's an opportunity missed to put a Tom Petty song on there when he includes a cover. And I'll be talking about this with John Paulson later this week, but if you look at some of the songs that didn't make the Greatest Hits album, that could have taken the place of Something in the Air, you can't help but feel that this really was a business decision at the label level, rather than something that Tom and the band felt really strongly about artistically. I'm sure that Tom would rather have seen Jammin' Me, A Woman in Love, or Change of Heart make that Greatest Hits record, and all of which, by the way, were top 10 hits on the Billboard rock chart. Okay, Pettyheads, that's it for this week. A rather different final song episode in this little interstitial season. I love Something in the Air as a song. I love that the Heartbreakers recorded it, but maybe I wish it had been a B-side, maybe. Maybe Mary Jane's Last Dance, instead of being a single and being on the album. I will take any one of about 10 songs to include on the Greatest Hits record instead of it, but it's a rock-solid cover, and for Howie's bass and co-lead vocals alone, this one has to sit above average. So, like Feel a Whole Lot Better, I'm going to give Something in the Air a 7 out of 10. The Tom Petty Project is a proud member of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. Go check us out on Twitter at Deep Dive Podnet. I'm sure you'll find something there that you like. You can also check out my other podcast, Seaside Pod Review, a Queen podcast that I do with my best friend Randy Woods, as well as the Ultimate Catalogue Clash that I co-host with the hardest working man in podcasting, Corey Morissette. We're just starting to record season 3 now, and we've got a band that has a tangential link back to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. You should also check out this fantastic podcast.
This is Eric Senich, host of Booked on Rock. Join me for deep dive discussions of the greatest stories in rock history from the authors who've written all about them.
Ed Van Halen, one of the world's greatest guitarists. He ended on a great note, just like one of his solos.
And those who were there when they happened.
I'm fishing and I'm hearing Sweet Home, Alabama, 6 miles to where I'm fishing.
Find Booked on Rock wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, or just go to bookedonrock.com.
Don't forget to go follow me on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube at The Tom Petty Project, and on Twitter at Tom Petty Project. Go follow, like, subscribe, do all those things, and please leave a review or a rating if you haven't already. Keep talking to me on social media, and I'll keep reading out as many of your comments as I can on the show. And as a weekly reminder, The Tom Petty Project is not affiliated with the Tom Petty Estate in any way. So when you're looking for Tom's music, please visit all the official streaming platforms, or go buy a record. For God's sake, go buy a record. You know, if the internet collapses and we've got no internet anymore, at least we've still got our vinyl. At least we've got our CDs. At least we've got our tapes. Maybe some of you've even got 8-tracks. Go buy an 8-track. If you're looking for official merchandise, please go to tompetty.com. And if you're looking for merchandise for this show, go to tompettyproject.com. Don't forget to check out the Tom Petty Nation and Tom Petty Fans Forever groups on Facebook. They're great little fan communities and well worth spending a little bit of time in. Until we meet again next week, keep listening to and sharing Tom's music. Try to be kind. Try to say I love you to someone at least once a day. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll be back with you next week with the next installment in my Petty 8 series with Sean and Todd McGinnity of the Sean Geek and Fast Fret podcast. Bye-bye.